Good evening. Let's begin by cultivating our motivation for tonight. As human beings, we have an amazing capacity to cultivate and express love and compassion and to really cherish others. And we know that we're much happier when we express love and compassion. We also have an amazing capacity to utilize our human intelligence, to cultivate discernment and wisdom. We can understand cause and effect, consequences. We can think in the long term. But when we succumb to afflictions like anger and attachment, then we lose this potential temporarily. And as these afflictions distort our perceptions, they impel confused actions, harmful actions oftentimes, that lead to suffering for ourselves and others in the short and long term. And so we can and we should apply antidotes when the afflictions arise. But just think how much more efficient it is if we go after the root of all afflictions, self-grasping ignorance. And to do that, we need to develop our wisdom, especially the wisdom realizing emptiness, the subtle nature of all reality. And since emptiness is a hidden phenomena, then we'll need to develop the necessary tools to first develop a correct understanding, and then to familiarize with that, shore up the reasons, and develop an inferential cognition of that. And again, familiarizing with that again and again and again until we can produce a direct perception of emptiness and begin abandoning, eliminating all the afflictions and their seeds and the traces that they leave behind. And so that's one reason that we're studying this course in Buddhist reasoning and debate, to grow our skill and wisdom. And just like us, all beings also suffer continuously due to the force of ignorance, repeatedly taking rebirth, experiencing aging, sickness, death, the unwanted. And so we aspire to be of greatest benefit to all these beings, our brothers and sisters. And so to provide the benefit required, then we cultivate our own good qualities of compassion and wisdom first and share that with others. In fact, our motivation for developing our own good qualities is so that we can be of greatest benefit to others. And so let's engage with the material tonight, the review of a couple of chapters 7 and 8, with these aspirations in mind. Venerable Chodron has just begun a 5-week teaching tour. This week she began teaching in Boston. She gave a talk at the Harvard Divinity School and also the FPMT Center in Boston, Kurukula. And now she's in the Netherlands. I think she's arrived there. From the Netherlands, she goes on to Denmark and then Germany and then Russia and then back to the Netherlands. So in the meantime, tonight I thought it would be good to review chapters 7 and 8. And then if there's time, we can go back to chapter 9, the chapter that we have been studying. And we'll see how far we get tonight. Okay, so we've been learning about the elements of syllogisms and how to construct a correct syllogism, and we've all had some experience of trying to put those together concerning our daily life, the things that we encounter on a daily basis. And it seems like people are starting to get the hang of it, of how to check for the property of the subject and to see if the forward pervasion stands and the counter pervasion. So let's just review those three modes quickly. One thing that we don't often talk about when we're looking to check the property of the subject, and that is the very first thing that we're going to check. If the property of the subject is not established, there's no reason to go any further to look at the forward provision. So that's where we begin. And one thing I notice that we don't talk about much is checking to the subject to make sure it's a valid subject of interest. And so as Professor Perdue spelled out earlier in the text, there are these, the proper subject has to meet these two criteria. First of all, it's the subject, it's the subject that is held as the basis of debate. So it occupies that first space in the syllogism, take the subject or consider the subject. And then the second criteria is that there must be a person who has ascertained the property of the subject. So they understand that the subject has the quality of the reason. And also they have a doubt about the thesis. So that's an important criteria to be there. They have to have a doubt, an active doubt about the thesis. So in our practice, some of us were coming up with some good syllogisms. Some of the syllogisms I noticed were stating things as a thesis that you probably wouldn't wonder about. You probably already know. So that's just something to keep in mind as we go further, that we're really trying to understand something about that predicate and its relation to the subject. Okay? So that's the property of the subject. And if the property of the subject is not matching up, if the reason is not a quality of the subject, then what do we say?
The reason is not established.
The reason is not established. That's right. So, or you can just say not established, reason not established. Okay, then we check the forward provision. And so how do we do that?
Whatever is the reason must necessarily be the predicate.
Whatever is the reason must necessarily be the predicate. That's right. And the counter provision?
Whatever is not the predicate is necessarily not the reason.
Right. So whatever is not the predicate is necessarily not the reason. And what we've seen is that if the forward provision is established, it's invariably the case that the counter provision is also established at the same time. Okay, so let's have a look at chapter 7. And I think chapter 7 can be summarized really very quickly, at least in my mind. Let's see if it works. So in a nutshell, I think chapter 7 is simply highlighting the fact that in a correct syllogism, the reason and the predicate will either be equal in extent, in other words, they'll be mutually pervasive, or the reason will be smaller than the predicate. The predicate will pervade the reason, like we've seen when we talk about three possibilities, 3P, three possibilities. That's, I think that's really in a nutshell what it's saying. It's just trying to get us to, he's trying to get us to see in our mind that that's going to be, the relationship between the reason and the predicate is going to be one of those two situations. Okay, so let's look at a couple of examples so that we can see that. And he's drawn it just looking at the reason and the predicate together. But I think it might be helpful to actually see it in a syllogistic form, just to have another visual to help us get that relationship. Okay, so our standard syllogism, take sound, it's a...
Sound is an impermanent phenomena. It would be better if this was theater, because of the product. So if we were going to draw impermanent and being a product, or impermanent phenomenon and product, how would those circles look? They'd be the same size, wouldn't they? Those are exactly the same size. Can you tell? Okay. What about sound? What would the size of sound be?
Smaller.
Smaller. Okay, so in this relationship, he's drawn it like this. He said P and Q, mm-hmm. as if
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's inside.
Yeah.
All right. Can you think of a syllogism that where we would find the extent of the reason being smaller than the predicate?
maybe using some of the ideas that we were studying in Chapter 9 on selfless.
Something isn't existent because of being a product.
Okay.
So in this example, it's going to be different, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So how's it going to be? Which is going to be the larger circle that pervades the smaller circle?
Existence.
Right. Existence bigger and product is smaller. What is something that's an existent that's not a product? For example?
Permanent phenomena
or probably good to give a specific example like uncompounded space, correct. Okay. And again, sound would even be smaller. So here in this situation, I'm not sure what he called P and Q, but one of them will be P and one of them will be Q. This is three possibilities. In other words, the reason is going to be a subset of the predicate. Those are the only two relationships. And I think the reason he might be highlighting this is to help us see the forward pervasion. Because when we are identifying what is the forward pervasion, we're looking to see if it's a product, is it necessarily impermanent? Are these two going to be mutually inclusive? Or are these two, if it's a product, is it necessarily going to be inexistent? In both cases, we can see that that's the case. So I think it's just a way to highlight that relationship and to begin seeing it. This becomes important when we start talking about proof statements, which might be coming later, I'm not sure. But in a proof statement, you would say something like, whatever is a product is necessarily impermanent. For example, a cup. Sound is also a product, or itself. Sound is also a product. Yeah. That helps you understand. Sound is also a product. Let me check on that. Not sure of this one. Okay. I think that's chapter 7 in a nutshell. Can you think of anything else that he's trying to emphasize there? He's trying to give us a visual. Yeah. Venerable Losong.
Also, it gives you a check if you're reason is more extensive than your predicate, then you know you have a problem.
Yes, that's a good point.
So if it's 3P in the wrong direction with the wrong pervasion.
Yeah, that's a good point to highlight. Right, the pervasion is only going to go one way. So, for instance, if we find in checking the forward pervasion that the reason is pervading the predicate and not the other way around, then we know that we don't have a correct syllogism. That's a good point. Okay, anything else about that? And I suspect that the exercises were just really helping us to become familiar with those concepts. I can't see anything in addition to that. Okay, now in that chapter, we looked at two correct nature reasons, didn't we? There's a relationship, what's called an essential relationship or a natural relationship between the reason and the predicate. But how does this work for correct effect reasons? Do you think it would work for correct effect reasons as well? He just gave us examples of correct nature reasons. When we're comparing a reason and a predicate in a correct nature reason, there's an essential relationship. Yes, or at least some part, you know. Like, for instance, if it's a subset, You can't have the smaller of the sub, you can't have the subset without the larger category, but you can have the larger category without the subset. Okay. It's just interesting. I found it interesting that they don't talk about the pervasion very much when we look at cause and effect, like in a correct effect reason. So I'm just bringing it up as a question. What I did find in Catherine Rogers' Tibetan Logic book, just one brief mention of it. She says, if the effect exists, necessarily the cause, well, it has existed, hasn't it? It's not existing at the same time. So there's not pervasion in the same moment. But where there is pervasion is that when a person realizes the cause and effect relationship between the predicate and the reason, then it is said that they understand the pervasion. So it's a slightly different understanding of that word pervasion. It's pervasive in a different way, but it's still, we can still say it's pervasive. If the effect is there, it is pervasive that the cause has existed, right? You can't have an effect without a cause. You can't have a cause without an effect, and that's why he cautions us. Although I found in some of the syllogisms I was making up that I wanted to put the effect in the place of the predicate. But actually, in most of the examples that are given, there's a subject, and then there's the cause in the place of the predicate, and then the effect in the place of the reason. So that's just something to be aware of. Some of these things that we might have questions about, we can make a note of, and hopefully we will have teachings with Geshe Thabke later this year on Pramana Vartika, which is the basis for these teachings on logic and reasoning, and we can ask him to explain some of the things that we don't quite understand thoroughly. So I've put that in my question mark, my question notes. Okay, so let's go on to chapter 8 then, and this is about the three types of correct reasons. So again, a little more review on that subject. And just a good thing to keep in mind, in the system of the sutra school following reason, that's the point of view from which the genre of collected topics is presented, then subtle self-grasping ignorance is the root cause of sentient being suffering. And, of course, that leads to distorted attention. I was thinking this afternoon, where would tender needs fall? Or missed experiences? Or, how are they included in this chain of events? What do you think? So we would have ignorance. We'd have distorted attention. That leads to oftentimes to afflictions, not always, but oftentimes to afflictions, and then to contaminated actions and contaminated results, suffering. So where do you think some of these things that this week we've been working on NVC with our excellent trainer, Lachelle Lochardet, and so how do they play into this? How I was thinking of it is that, for instance, this afternoon we were doing an exercise on missed experiences. And I was noticing for myself, there's certain things that I'm wanting, and then that's going to put a certain filter on how I see and hear things, because I have this tender need that's unmet. And so there's going, probably that comes before distorted attention, because I already have that bias. See what your own experience is, but because I already have that bias, then I'm discerning in a certain way already, and then probably giving attention to certain things in a distorted way, that will tend to lead to reactivity, right? And what is reactivity? It's affliction, right? Most times it's tainted with affliction, and then actions, body and speech start going crazy, and then all the rest. So just something good to think about. This afternoon in the BBC, Lachelle was trying to tie MVC together with our Buddhist practice, and that's another way that we can think about it. So there's this whole chain of events that starts with self-grasping ignorance. And each of the tenet schools will have their own identification of what that self-grasping ignorance is, what the object of negation is, what that self-grasping ignorance is. We don't need to worry about that so much right now. But to reverse that process, we're going to have to develop wisdom that's going to counter whatever that mode of apprehension of that self-grasping is. So, for instance, the sutra school says that the most subtle type of self-grasping ignorance is, they don't assert a phenomena, do they? They don't. So their main affliction, their root of cyclic existence would be grasping at a self of person, and they're grasping at what? What kind of person?
Self-sufficient.
A self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Right. Okay, so to counter that, we're going to need to develop a wisdom that has an opposite way of apprehending the person. Right? That's going to be the wisdom that we're looking to develop. Okay, so on page 132, Dan Perdue has a nice statement. He says, these three types of correct reasons support Buddhist learning and practice because they train a person in three things: cause and effect, the entity or nature of things, and the way of understanding the existence of something by a negative route of reasoning. So cause and effect, that those line up with the three types of correct reasons, don't they? So for example, correct effect reason, cause and effect, correct effect reasons were set forth to help us understand the relationship between, for instance, the suffering of cyclic existence and the causes of suffering, the origin of suffering, and between the cessation of suffering and the path leading to that cessation. So it brings us back to, really, we want to understand these three types of reasoning because they relate to the Four Noble Truths. That's the essence of what the Buddha taught. That's the essence of monastic training or really any kind of Dharma training, isn't it? Okay, so to understand the Four Noble Truths, it is essential to understand the nature of cause and effect. Suffering arises as a result of causes and is eliminated through eliminating those causes. So by understanding that cause and effect, that effects arise from causes, and whatever is produced has its own unique causes, that helps us to understand the necessity of engaging in certain practices and avoiding others for the sake of spiritual practice. Okay, so it's good to really get clearly in your mind that the incorrect effect reasons, the effect is stated as the reason. The effect is stated as the reason. So one way to think about that is the predicate comes first, so that's got to be the cause. The effect comes later, that's got to be the reason. Cause and effect. Okay, so that's good to hang on to, because then when we're starting to look at our pervasions, then it's very clear in your mind, if there's an effect, there is necessarily a cause, right? If there's an effect, the reason, there is necessarily the cause, the predicate. So the forward pervasion, we're looking to see if that's established. We can see or know the effect oftentimes, but the cause is hidden to us. It could be a manifest thing, like fire is a manifest phenomena, but it could be hidden to us, maybe because it's on the other side of the mountain. Or, for instance, in our own continuum, we might experience manifest suffering, physical suffering, mental suffering, emotional suffering, but the cause is a hidden phenomena, isn't it? It's a very hidden phenomena. It's a karmic seed in our mind stream. So they say we need to prove that. Okay, so on a Smoky Mountain pass, there is fire, the cause, because there is smoke. And we use inference all the time in our lives, don't we? We use deductive reasoning. Sometimes it's correct, sometimes it's erroneous. But another example of that is similar to what I was just describing. In the continuum of an ordinary being who is experiencing manifest suffering of suffering, so a stub toe, a heartache, whatever it might be, seeds of negativity exist because suffering exists. So let's just play with that for a moment. Okay, so in the continuum of an ordinary being who is experiencing manifest suffering of suffering, let's look to see if the property of the subject is established. So in the continuum of an ordinary being experiencing manifest suffering, suffering exists. That works, doesn't it? If suffering exists, necessarily seeds of negativity exist. I wonder if you'd have to tighten that up a little bit and say, if suffering exists in one's continuum. I don't know. This would stand in debate, because I've taken this from something that Geshe Taji Sering handed out to us. But it just seems like it's a little bit general, doesn't it? But, here's one way we could say it. If suffering exists, its cause, seeds of negativity, exist. That way we're linking the seeds of negativity being the cause to that suffering, right? Otherwise, we're just talking about seeds of negativity exist. Well, seeds of negativity exist all the time. But are they necessarily the cause of that suffering? No, there's not a causal relationship, is there? So I think just to be safe as beginning debaters, it would be good to make sure that we're matching its cause. You know, so if suffering exists, necessarily the seeds of negativity that are its cause exist or have existed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, have existed. So it's a very long subject, isn't it? It's really trying to narrow down where's this suffering and where are these seeds? In the continuum of an ordinary being who is experiencing manifest suffering of suffering, or you could just say suffering of suffering. If it's suffering of suffering, it's manifest, right? I would think. Okay. So in the continuum of an ordinary being who is experiencing suffering of suffering, seeds of negativity exist. Okay. Because suffering exists. So how are we going to add that part in to make this make sense? I should have thought about this earlier. Okay.
Because suffering exists in that continuum.
Yeah, perhaps you would say seeds of negativity exist in that continuum because suffering exists in that continuum. That would tighten it up. That's showing a causal. At least it's in the same continuum. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not quite as tight as saying seeds of negativity, its cause, exists because suffering exists. Yeah, it's a little awkward. But if we were going to look at the pervasion, then you might add, okay, let's see if the pervasion works with that way I just said it. Suffering exists in that, if suffering exists in that, or wherever suffering exists in a continuum, seeds of negativity exist in that continuum, or have existed in that continuum. Does that make sense? So we're establishing the causal relationship. What do you think about that? Okay, well, it works for this group.
The original syllogism, then, would you need to have changed it to negative seeds existed? Because when you're doing the pervasion, we're changing it to past tense, but in the original syllogism, it's still in present tense.
Yeah, sometimes in situations like this, it's hard to know, was this as intended this way, or was this perhaps a translation issue? Yeah. When we look at, there are actually five or six different types of correct effect reasons. There's like a direct cause, there's like an indirect cause, there's like a previous cause. They're different relationships. But what we know about cause and effect is that they can't exist at the same time, right? So to say, yeah, maybe it's a given that if suffering exists, it's okay. On a Smoky Mountain pass, fire exists because smoke exists. Smoke is the product or the effect of fire. They do exist at the same time, but the fire that exists at the same time in the smoke is not the cause of the smoke. But that's another way where it's stated as if they exist at the same time. So perhaps that's okay. We can ask about this. Or just to put a positive spin on this too, because it's also true that in the continuum of ordinary beings experiencing manifest pleasure, maybe eating a piece of pie, positive seeds, positive seeds exist because pleasure exists. So that's a little bit more about why we should be interested in these correct effect reasons. They directly relate to our understanding of cause and effect in terms of karma and our interest in developing more causes of happiness, fewer causes of suffering, as they relate to our practice of the Four Noble Truths, right? Especially the first two truths. Yeah.
Different effect reasons that you mentioned, based on the different kinds of, I think it was causes that there are. Remember in the first debate book, there's all these indirect cause, direct cause, blah, 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 blah.
I think so.
Are they kind of the same?
Yeah. Yeah. You'll find that in Catherine's book, if you want to take a more extensive look. I've also got a list of some examples of the different types of reasons that help make it clearer. He didn't go into that level of detail at this point because we're not actually studying logic and reasoning necessarily. We're studying how to debate. So we're not going into all the nitty-gritty of logic and reasoning. He's giving us enough to get started, really.
I read in her book that they spend usually about 2 or 3 years doing what we're doing before they even get into those topics.
Yeah.
They just learn kind of how to debate first and then for a few years, and then they get into all this refinement.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't find it quickly, but you'll find it in her book, I'm sure. Okay, then we have correct nature reasons, and these were set forth as a means for understanding that all things are impermanent by nature, and also in the nature of suffering. They support realizations that true sufferings, for example, our own contaminated aggregates, are impermanent and miserable. So as we've discussed with this syllogism that we've used many times now, sound is an impermanent phenomenon because of being a product. The impermanence that we're talking about here is a slightly hidden phenomenon. It's subtle impermanence. That doesn't immediately appear to direct perception, any of our sense perceptions. However, through reasoning, we can generate an inference capable of leading to a direct realization of subtle impermanence. Wouldn't that be amazing? And this directly counters holding the self as permanent, which was a very strongly held idea at the time of the Buddha. And actually, if you think about it, if you challenged certain Christian tenets, you might find people, if you say, well, God created everything. God created man. Who created God? Well, nobody. So God is causeless, right? That would mean God is permanent. That's just a natural consequence of that kind of logic. Even in today's theologies, we could find evidence of maybe not conscious ideas or conscious assertions that things are impermanent, or like heaven's permanent, or I don't know. We could debate some of these assertions, but. So this is impermanent because many of the non-Buddhists at the time of the Buddha asserted a permanent creator. Also because grasping at permanence, thinking this life is going to last forever, really narrows our focus to the pleasures of this life. That's what we're going to think is important if we're not thinking beyond just this one life. If we think this life is going to go on forever, well, then we'll focus on getting as much pleasure in this life as we possibly can. So that's another reason that actually proving subtle impermanence to ourselves. Like, my aggregates are impermanent because they're a product. My aggregates are impermanent because they're a product of causes and conditions. There are many syllogisms that we could make to hone in and really think about the nature of our constantly changing body and mind as a basis for this imputation of I. So that can be very helpful. It keeps death and impermanence forefront in our mind, which, as we've read in the Lam Rim, is very important. So there are some syllogisms like this one. Take this basis of freedom and fortunes obtained by myself. It is impermanent because it's produced. So you could use the aggregates, or you could take this basis of freedom and fortunes. It's really getting at the same thing, isn't it?
Can you say that syllogism again?
Take this basis of freedom and fortunes obtained by oneself. I'm not sure why. There's probably some debate reason that's important to add. I don't know what it is. So take this basis of freedom and fortunes obtained by oneself. It is impermanent because it's produced, or because it's a product, because of being a product. So think about it. When you look in the mirror in the morning, do you think, look, there's a constantly changing body and mind? Or at least a constantly changing body? Or does something permanent appear to you? Something permanent, inherent, enduring? But that's something that we can begin training not only with syllogisms, but also every time you look in the mirror. Just really think about, oh, there's an appearance of a permanent self or a permanent body. Doesn't exist that way. It's a product of causes and conditions. The older you look, the easier that is to recognize. Amen, sister. Okay. All right, so not much more about correct nature reasons or essence reasons. There are different translations for these, of course, so you'll read different translation terms. And then the last one, the last type of correct reason is a correct non-observation reason. And it was interesting reading in Catherine Rogers' book that there actually is some debate about whether the predicate needs to be a negative, stated in a negative way. And in general, they say yes, in general. But there are some people who might have a different point of view on that. And I didn't read far enough to really understand that thoroughly, so that's all I'm going to say. So when the predicate is proven to be proven, the predicate to be proven, or the predicate is a negative phenomena, these were set forth for the sake of realizing that all things, especially true sufferings, are empty and selfless. So there's a mixture here of the Four Noble Truths and the Four Seals, aren't there? And actually the four aspects of true suffering, impermanent suffering, empty and selfless. Yeah. So the classic example is, take the subject, the self, it's empty of inherent existence because it's a dependent arising. So necessarily the predicate is negative or stated in a negative way. And it could also be the case that the reason is stated in a negative way, but not necessarily. In Tibetan logic, they really love to introduce negations, not nots. And it does sharpen your mind. You really have to think, okay, the non-not, what is that? There are different types of correct non-observation reasons. When something is suitable to appear, if something is not suitable to appear. There's a third one, it's not popping up right now. There's a famous one, in the space in front. I should have reviewed this, and I didn't. It's something about a flesh eater. See, I don't have the capacity to see a flesh eater, so I can't say that there is not a flesh eater here in the space in front. So in the space in front, something like, there is not a flesh eater. Do you want me to get, I can get the,
no,
okay.
Just trying to get a sense of what it means to have a suitable one or a.
Yeah, okay, so that's not suitable appear to me because I'm an ordinary being who can't see those things. But what's an example of, if there is something that I could see if it were there, that's suitable to appear.
Very so quickly. Kind of like you have to be a special kind of being? Like you have to have special powers?
Well, in that instance, yes. But the fact is, to really know something, you have to be able to develop a direct perception of it. Mm-hmm. Some things we can, if it were there, we could develop a direct perception of it. Some things we couldn't because, for instance, we don't have that capacity. Let me bring it next week and we can look at, because I've got some easier to understand examples up there. Okay, so that really is the gist, I think, of chapter 8 on these correct effect signs, correct nature signs, correct non-observation signs or reasons. That was another short chapter. Was there anything else? That's really it. I find in my own study that it's good to, I think this is why Venerable suggested it. She said, read through the chapter and just summarize. That's a very effective way of studying because then you are forced to pull out the points that are important to you and then just summarize them. So we're familiarizing when we do that, right? We're also making a nice handy little cheat sheet. So if we want to review later, it's there. We don't have to go back and read the whole book. So I encourage you to think about doing that. Or at least going back and reading the chapter and underlining, you know, have your own marking system. I'm sure you already do that. So chapter 9, basic Buddhist ontology. Basically, ontology means the theory of what exists. I think we can say that. But I did look it up in the, and Wikipedia had this to say about ontology. This term was introduced in 1606, so I don't know what the Buddhists called it before. But anyway, it says, ontology is the philosophical study of the nature of being, becoming, existence or reality, as well as the basic categories of being and their relations. Traditionally listed as part of the major branch of philosophy known as metaphysics, ontology often deals with questions concerning what entities exist or may be said to exist, and how such entities are grouped, related within a hierarchy, and subdivided according to similarities and differences. A very simple definition of ontology is that it is the examination of what is meant by being or what exists. So you might remember, some of you who were here when we did the study of tenets, presentation of tenets in Cutting Through Appearances. Thank you. Yep. Yep. Presentation of tenets. Precious garland of tenets. Right. Thank you. Venerable Dhamsha's on it. You might remember from studying those tenets that each of the schools was divided into four sections. Does something appear to your mind when I say that? Do you remember? Definition, divisions, etymology. Yes, but what is basis, past, and fruit a subset of? Assertion of tenets. Right. Okay, so that's a tidy little way of thinking about what each of the different tenet schools asserts. And then within assertion of tenets, you have the assertion of the basis, what exists, the assertion of the path, how you, you know, how you overcome suffering, and then the result, what they assert as the result of the path. So in the first one, the assertion of the basis, that's where each school is going to talk about their assertions regarding objects and also subjects. So objects, as we have begun to understand, objects is anything that's observed by an awareness. Is that the definition? That which is observed by a reliable cognizer. That's an existent, sorry. Is that what I said? Objects. No, objects is different. Okay. Object is that which is known by an awareness.
Objects and knowledge.
Just objects. They're distinct definiendums, and they have distinct definitions. So each of these, as we'll see in this, the beginning of this chapter, there are these eight synonyms for things that exist, phenomena that exist. Okay. Now, why I was bringing that up is the assertion of objects. Subjects are minds, aren't they? Like the kinds of minds that know objects, but subjects are also objects. But they're divided in terms of objects and what is knowing the objects. Just like selflessness of person, the person, the basis for that selflessness, the person is a phenomena, but they're distinguished or they're separated out for a particular reason. So it's the same way here. Even though subjects or minds are actually objects, they are suitable to be known by an awareness, they're singled out because each of these tenet schools are wanting to prove what exists. And how do you do that? You have to assert some kind of reliable cognition that's going to know what exists. So that's why they're distinguished that way. Anyway, I just thought to tie that together. Chapter 9 in our debate text matches up nicely with the chapter in collected topics on established bases. So that's one of the synonyms, isn't it? Established base, that which is established by valid cognition. And so this is the sutra school following reasonings essential introductory description of ontology. This is how they, this is what they say exists. And this is, as Dan Perdue says, this is considered the single most important chapter in Collected Topics because it's laying out the framework. Here's how things exist. First of all, the largest category is selfless. And then from there, it's divided into existence and non-existence. And then from there, into more detail. So that's like going to be the working basis for all the other subjects that we find in Collected Topics. So Dan Perdue says, he goes so far as to say, without a thorough familiarity with the topics presented in this chapter, one cannot hope to understand Collected Topics or Buddhist reasoning. Okay, that's a pretty good inspiration to really make some effort with this chapter and memorizing the definitions so that we can begin debating them. That's the point. If you carry the definitions around with you, you can debate anywhere with anyone. If you have to stop and look them up in your book, like I just did, that's going to slow you down. So as we go through this chapter, then it's really good to commit this to memory. And one good way to do that, one fun way to do that, is to find a partner and just go back and forth. Like, for instance, Venerable Nima and I have been memorizing the 41 gathas. I could sit in my room and memorize them on my own, but it's a heck of a lot more fun to get together with Venerable Nima and go back and forth. And then when we see each other in the dining room, we say, what's number 9? Or what's number 12? And it's more fun. And I suspect that's one of the reasons. I mean, if you look at the monks, they're not sitting passively and just talking with each other. They're having fun, you know? They're energetic, they're engaged. And so perhaps that has some effect on our capacity to remember. Or like, for instance, when I'm studying with someone else, they might have a mnemonic or a way of remembering something that is just funny. And so chances are it will stick in my mind because, oh yeah, the way she said that was really funny. And then it sticks in your mind. So just an idea. So as we've learned, the broadest possible category that includes existence as well as non-existence is the selfless. All Buddhist tenet systems assert selflessness as the main principle of their philosophies, although each system has a unique understanding of a certain type of self that selfless refers to. So why is this important to us? Because, as we discussed earlier, one of the fundamental assertions in Buddhism is that only through understanding the ultimate nature of things, the selflessness or the emptiness, persons, at least persons, in the consequent school phenomena as well, then we can gain liberation. We can free ourselves from suffering, free ourselves from powerless rebirth. Okay, so this description of the selfless can only be helpful if it's accurate. And even if the description is accurate, this is from Dan Perdue, he says, merely being able to repeat these words describing reality is not knowledge, it's not wisdom. Rather, we're advised to take these words and to test them closely so that we can actually gain the knowledge and wisdom ourselves so that we can generate a reliable cognition of reality. That's really the purpose of what we're doing. Okay, so just a little review. In the fundamental vehicle, which would include the Great Exposition School and the Sutra School, they don't assert a selflessness of phenomena because they assert the view of that external phenomena truly exist. Both of those schools. But all Buddhist tenet systems agree that everything, every object, every person, is free of being a permanent, unitary, independent self, even non-existence. Therefore, even for fundamental vehicle proponents, all phenomena are selfless, even those that don't exist. There was another more detailed explanation of that too. Do you remember how we learned for the Great Exposition and Sutra School? Not only was the person empty of being a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, but everything else was empty of being an object of use of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. And so, although they don't assert selflessness of phenomena, you could say that phenomena are included within the selfless. because they're not an object of use of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person.
Okay. Can you say that again regarding all phenomena are selfless, even for the fundamental vehicle followers?
Mm-hmm.
But they do not assert a selflessness of phenomena?
Right. So in their tenets, they say that the root of cyclic existence is grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. But they assert truly existent phenomena that are based on partless particles, and you know, there's a whole theory of those things. Truly, they assert truly, each of the tenet schools are going to have a more refined view of the relationship between the mind and the object. Which one has more power, you know? So even though they don't assert a selflessness of phenomena, they assert that phenomena or external objects truly exist. At the same time, they say that that object of any phenomena, like this cup is empty of being an object of use of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So in a sense, they're extending this understanding of lacking self-sufficient, substantial existence. It's really referring to the person. But somehow they're also including that all phenomena are empty of that quality of being able to be used by such a person. So in that way, you can say this is also selfless.
So the selflessness is because the person...
There's no
who uses it
right.
is selfless. That's where it gets this quality of
right. It's being kind selfless. Of a maybe you could say it's a pseudo selflessness of phenomena. They wouldn't call it a selflessness of phenomena because they say this cup truly exists. It's an external object that truly exists.
That's,
you know, if you searched for an illustration within the basis, you would find it.
Okay, I find that tricky.
Okay, we'll need to go back to tenets to mm-hmm. review that. And then in the great vehicle or universal vehicle, tenet schools, mind only, middle way autonomy, middle way consequence, and the selfless is divided into two, selflessness of person and selflessness of phenomena, both coarse and subtle for both of those. Okay, so selfless means that all that exists arises dependently. All existence are dependent arisings. At least from the consequence point of view. So in order to understand selflessness, since that's the largest category, then it's necessary to understand the phenomena that are the basis for that selflessness. And so that's why initially we're studying what exists, in other words, objects, and how we can know those existence subjects. This collected topics chapter on established bases, what exists and what does not exist, serves as the basis or the bedrock for Buddhist reasoning and debate. And as Dan Perdue reminds us, he said, let your epistemology inform your ontology, not the other way around. And as Venerable Tarpa kindly explained that to us, in other words, we have to know our methodology for how things exist before we can start proving that things exist.
Book, like say the book by Anne Klein about knowledge and liberation is a great example of this. Pretty much all the stuff that we do, like all the topics in Low Rig, most of the topics of the path, all these things we think about how inference leads to a, you wear away the veil till you have a direct realization. All of that is our theory of knowledge of how we can know things. So pretty much most of what we're practicing, it falls in that. And through having a way that we know we can get, I would say, is my words, valid cognitions, then we can figure out what exists, which is how things exist, which is the ontology.
Hmm.
But we actually are starting from figuring out how we're going to know that. And we have all these, each school has every paradigm, everyone has their various paradigms, and the prasankas have their paradigm. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear, but he never explains it. Daniel Perdue never does. But mm-hmm. When I read different books, I say, "Oh, gosh, they're talking about everything we do." You know, it was like kind of shocked me because I didn't know what he was talking about at all at first.
Mm-hmm.
That makes any sense.
Yes, and please continue to talk about it with us when you understand new levels of that. What I understand from the different tenet schools and the way they study in the monasteries is that they begin with some introductory subjects like tenets, well, not so much tenets, but like Lohrig, mind and awareness. That's taught from the sutra school point of view as well. Collected topics, sutra school point of view. So for a number of years, the monks and the nuns just study the sutra school point of view. They get that down really well as the basis. And then at some point, they're introduced to the mind-only school point of view. And the way it's described, the way I've heard Geshe Tashi Sering describe it, is that for a while, the monks and nuns are walking around like, what? No, it's this way. This is how we've learned it. But they're being introduced to the next level of subtlety. And so then they have to shift their orientation a bit. And then, you know, eventually they graduate to the mind or the middle way autonomy point of view. And only at the very end are they introduced to these most subtle concepts from the consequence point of view. If we started our study at that level, probably most of us wouldn't be able to understand it. So the way I have heard it explained is that it's a gradation from coarse understanding, the coarsest understanding, to the most subtle understanding. And my experience of studying the middle way topic is that a lot of the middle way texts are about those refinements of the middle way consequence point of view and how you prove them. How you negate the more coarse views and how you prove the more subtle views.
I think this is why they have people study the non-Buddhist schools and other schools too, because for instance, like when Jay was here, he was saying, well, do you Buddhists posit that you can actually know reality through thought? And actually, yes, we do in the school that we study. We say that you can actually know reality, maybe not as clearly as you would with a direct perception, but that inference is you are realizing subtle impermanence. You are realizing emptiness. You're not realizing it as fully because it's a conceptual thought, but we are getting at it. That right there is this idea of epistemology, big time. And so the only way for me I could understand that was reading these other books where they're comparing and contrasting. Because there's like in the Sakya, I read one thing recently that they don't necessarily separate all the different people in Sakya conceptual from direct perception. I read something like Sakya Pandita didn't necessarily do this. I'm like, really? How did he figure? You know, it's like, well, I haven't ever studied that. But, you know, it's just that there's all these different thoughts. And in India, there were many different ideas, too. I think that's why it all started with Dignaga and Dharmakirti in a certain way, because they kind of formulated the Buddhist approach to the theory of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is what Venerable Chinni was studying in India this last year. And like I said, this is what Geshe Thapke will be introducing us to later this year sometime. We haven't settled on a date yet.
One other thing about that graduated way of learning that is you learn a point of view and then you have to let go of it to learn the next thing a little bit. Mm. And we already tend to have points of view, and learning to let go of them is probably a very handy thing, and you have to learn that a lot if you're going through a lot of steps.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very useful. Okay. Page 139 was something I wanted to point to. Yeah, in that first full paragraph, he says, in the collected topics tradition of Buddhist reasoning and debate, the usual way of explaining a topic includes presentations of the definitions, the divisions of the phenomena, and illustrations or examples. It is essential to put these in mind in order to be able to understand the few topics introduced here, practice the debates, and gain the skills. Think of this approach as looking for the essential characteristics of things. In fact, in Tibetan, the study of philosophy is known as sani, meaning definitions, characteristics, or qualities. If you think that seems a quaint way of studying philosophy, think of the analysis of whether or not a tomato is a fruit, whether or not glass is liquid, or whether or not Pluto is a planet. Do those things keep you up at night? So think about divisions. They're very informative, aren't they? For example, we often divide the people here at the Abbey into residents and non-residents, or residents and guests, I guess you could say, or bhikshus, bhikshunis, shiksamanas, shramanaris, shramaneras, and lay people. What else? Anagarga, sorry, I meant to include you.
Cats.
Different countries we're from. How else do we differentiate? Male, female. Who can vote in Washington? Who can't vote in Washington? That becomes important, doesn't it? What citizen, not citizens, U.S. citizens?
What? Which building you live in?
Which building you live in?
Who drives, who doesn't drive?
Who drives well, who doesn't drive well? Who doesn't drive at all?
Who snores, who doesn't snore?
Who likes chocolate cake, who doesn't? Who's gluten-free, who can eat anything?
Who can lead chanting and who can't lead chanting?
So you see, we're differentiating all the time, aren't we? We're making divisions all the time. That's the point. Anything else? I'm sure there's many. Who's late to practice, who's not? Okay. Let's just draw this up here, just the basic,
the first step in our diagram.
Okay, and then of course under existence there's a whole, what would you call it? Diagram, a long schematic. Is the category selfless existent or non-existent? Why?
Because if a set has existence and non-existence, then it's necessarily existent. Just as a rule.
Yeah. Is the category selfless permanent or non-permanent? Why?
Yeah. If the set has a permanent in it, then the whole set is permanent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if we think about comparisons like mutually inclusive, mutually exclusive, four possibilities with or without something that's neither, three possibilities with or without something that's neither, how does the selfless compare to any existent or non-existent? Three possibilities without something that is neither. How did you come to that?
Because there's nothing that is not selfless, right? So there's nothing that is...
So that's the neither part.
The neither part, yeah. Uh-huh. Then if it's existent or non-existent, it is pervaded by being selfless, so it must be a smaller circle.
It's going to be a subset.
Inside of it.
Right. Okay, so let's just do a few examples, a few comparisons, so that we can really get this clear in our minds. How do the two compare, selfless and existent? So you said it's 3P. So what's something that's both, selfless and existent? A chair. Venerable Damcha. What's something that's selfless and not existent? Rabbit horn, horn of a rabbit. Is there something that is existent that is not selfless? No, that should appear clearly in your mind. There's nothing that is existent that is not selfless. Why? Because it's a subset. And there's nothing that's not selfless, so there's nothing that's neither, right? Because that is the largest category. There's nothing larger. There's nothing outside of selfless. Yep. Okay, so even though we call it 3P or three possibilities, with something that is neither, there's only two things you can posit. I think this is what drives Venerable crazy. That's why she says, let's just see what something that's both, and A not B, B not A. Okay, how about selfless and permanent?
Existent.
Permanent is a subset or pervaded by?
By existence.
Selfless is permanent, right. And selfless.
Oh, okay.
I don't have permanent up there, so it's right. A bit of a trick.
That's what I'm looking at, is that the permanent is a subset of selfless, but it's also an existent.
Mm-hmm. It's a subset
of existent.
Yeah.
So what am I being asked?
So how do the two compare, permanent and selfless?
If it's permanent, it's necessarily selfless.
If we're looking at, are they mutually inclusive, mutually exclusive, 3P, 4P?
3P.
3P, necessarily. 3P. If it's a subset, necessarily 3P. You can be confident about that.
Okay.
Yeah, That's right. So something that's both permanent and selfless. What's an example?
Emptiness.
Emptiness, yeah. And something that is selfless that is not permanent.
Venerable Chinny.
Yeah. Many things, right?
Yeah, many. Yeah.
Okay. And is there anything that is permanent that is not selfless?
No.
No. And is there anything that's neither?
No.
Okay, good. Excellent. So 3P with nothing that is neither. That's what that means. Anytime there's a subset, automatically, 3P. Okay? Three possibilities. That's what that means. All right. How about selfless and non-existent? Let me just say it's a bit of a trick question.
Yeah.
Selfless and non-existent.
When you compare things, non-existence can't be included because they have no characteristics to compare.
That's right.
So you're right. Yeah, you give us a trick question.
Well, I got to make sure you're awake. It's just 7:15.
But there's nothing that's neither.
There's definitely nothing that's neither, and there's nothing that's both.
So even though it's a subset of selfless, it's not a 3P?
Right. This is another convention. Because when we're comparing things, they have to have characteristics to compare. So I suppose, what would you say? What would be the word? You could posit their 3P if you were being really pedantic, you know? Non-existent is a division of selfless, but you can't compare it to selfless. I guess that's how you'd get around saying it. It's a division of selfless, but you can't compare it with selfless because there are no characteristics of non-existence. Okay, so that's good to keep in mind. Can't compare non-existence. Okay, how about selfless and pillar and pot, the two? Pillar and pot, the two. That's one, that's like B, and selfless, A. A and B, we're comparing those two things. This is another one that's a little bit challenging. Well, it's not...
There's nothing that is the two.
Yeah, nothing that is the two, so is it they're non-existent?
No, the pillar and pot, the two, exists. There is nothing that is it, but it's not a non-existent, because pillar exists and pot exists, so pillar and pot, the two, actually exists. But there is nothing that is it. Doesn't your mind feel sharper already? Okay, so let's go through and see what it might be. Is there something that is both selfless and pillar and pot, the two? There isn't. Right away, what do you know? If there's nothing that's both, right away, what do you know? Is it going to be mutually inclusive, mutually exclusive? Exclusive, right. So these are just little tips, little tricks that you figure out along the way. It's one of the reasons that you look to see if you can find something that's both to begin with. Because if there's nothing that's both, you know they're mutually exclusive. Or, well, if they're related, they're mutually exclusive. Is there something that is selfless that is not pillar or pot the two? For example?
Anything,
yeah. Anything that's selfless. And is there something that is pillar and pot, the two, that is not selfless? Well, okay, is there anything, yeah, is there anything that is pillar and pot, the two, that is not selfless?
And there's nothing that's pillar and pot.
There's nothing that's pillar and pot.
Is that two. A collection of pillar and pot?
Well, there is the category pillar and pot, so you can posit that. You can posit the category pillar and pot, the two. Even though there is nothing in that, there are no instances of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you have to have instances.
I took this from Dan Perdue's book.
Is that a Roman Rosalind?
143 in the notes. There you go.
Is that a Roman Rosalind debate?
Well, probably. Okay, so.
In this book.
Yes.
What's it say?
Okay, it says. It says, note that the description of an existent for which there is something that is that existent is different. Okay, that's a little confusing. Let's skip down. The example there is that definition, for instance, is not a definition. Okay, here the restriction of an existent for which there is something that is that existent is meant to exclude the existent of which being them is not possible. Okay, yeah, you just have to read it a few times. The stock example of this is the two, a pillar and a pot. There is nothing that is both a pillar and a pot. Therefore, in a comparison of the selfless and the two, a pillar and a pot, there is nothing you could put or posit as both selfless and the two, pillar and pot. So the selfless and the two, pillar and pot, would be mutually exclusive. This does not say that the two, a pillar and a pot, are not selfless, for they are. So see, we can posit that as an example of something that is pillar and pot, the two, but is not, are not selfless, for they are selfless. Okay, so we can't posit that. Okay, so they're mutually exclusive.
How can they be mutually exclusive and yet it's still selfless?
Because there's nothing that's both. This is an exception, and this will probably come up later and we can go into it in a lot more detail. Yeah, he's just throwing a curly one at us. So I'm throwing it to you. Something to think about.
So you can just keep making up these things.
Well, it may seem like they're making up these things, but actually if you were to sit down with Dan Perdue's book Debate, you would find that there are these stock things, these stock ideas or concepts that they go through in the Collected Topics textbooks. Probably each of the different colleges will have their own unique things that they bring up and debate. In a way, they're arbitrary, but in another way, they're not. They're a tool for sharpening the mind.
So we can make up our own empty
category.
The two. If you say the two, there is nothing that is both an apple and an orange.
So you juice them.
Well, there's still not something that's the two in nature. Okay, anyway, that's enough on that. I just, probably one trick question too many. All right. Then on page 144, he begins with the definition of existence, that which is observed by a reliable cognizer or cognition. I think you can use either term. A reliable cognizer is a correct certifying consciousness that incontrovertibly realizes its object. So reliable cognizers include direct perceivers and inferential cognizers. This is what we're aiming to develop in our own mental continuum so that we can know things in a very reliable way, in a very correct way, in a certifying way. So maybe you've heard this this progression of different types of mind, and we will study types of mind later in this book, this text. Some of you have studied Lorig awareness and knowers before, but we're going to go through it again. And the idea is that, well, like right now, we have a lot of wrong consciousnesses about how things exist. We grasp at things to exist in a permanent way or in an inherent way, and they don't exist that way. So we do have some wrong consciousnesses. But when we start hearing teachings, then we start developing some doubt, like, well, maybe things don't exist the way they appear to me. Venable's gone through this progression a number of times with us. So you develop doubt. And then if you keep going with your doubt and continue with your collecting knowledge, eventually you develop a correct assumption. And we probably have a lot of correct assumptions at this stage, those of you who've studied for a while. We have a lot of correct assumptions, but the danger of leaving things at the level of correct assumption is that someone can talk you out of it. It's not incontrovertible yet. It's not a very reliable, strong kind of mind. So as we'll see, there are various types of correct assumptions. Maybe you have a correct assumption, but no reason. You know, you just have the thesis, like everything is impermanent, every functioning thing is impermanent. But you don't yet have a reason to prove that to yourself. So you've got the right thesis, that's a correct assumption, but someone could come in here and give you a real line of logic and we might start believing them. So this is why it's dangerous to leave things at the level of correct assumption. We can be swayed. But then if we continue learning and provide a correct reason and then really work with that, eventually we can develop, especially with hidden phenomena, we can develop an inference, an inferential cognition. And that is a special type of reliable cognizer that is called incontrovertible. In other words, no one can talk you out of that. So let me give you an example of that. If I hold up this book and I say, notice the color of the cover of this book. Okay, so everybody has a direct perception, an eye perception, a sense direct, a valid sense perception of the color of this book. I don't think anybody's colorblind here, are they? Yellow's not included in that spectrum anyway. Now, if we went outside and let's say we had some visitors and they said, was Seppel holding up the purple book? You would say incontrovertibly, right? Without a doubt, you'd say, no, it was the color of that book was, the cover of that book was yellow. No one could talk you into thinking that was a purple cover. It might seem like a silly example, but it's one that we have direct experience with all day long. We have direct perceptions. We have valid cognitions already with our senses. You know, when we see a color, when we see a shape, when we hear a particular sound, when we smell something. Now, there is room for error there, but we have a lot of valid cognitions with our senses already. Where this becomes interesting is trying to develop valid cognitions with hidden phenomena, because those are the things we can't know with our senses. So like, for instance, subtle impermanence. If we really understood the subtle impermanence of all impermanent phenomena, all functioning things, we wouldn't have attachment for them, would we? You know, what's one of the best antidotes for attachment? Impermanence. Why? Because you understand it's constantly changing. It's not going to be here forever. Or as I've been saying all along, really the ultimate aim of our Buddhist practice is to realize the subtle nature of reality. Well, we can't see that with our eyes necessarily. We can't. We can't smell it. We can't touch it. We're going to have to get at that through developing a line of reasoning, an inference. We have to rely on a valid reason to begin with, and then familiarize with that again and again and again until we go through the veils like you were talking about. Those veils become thinner and thinner and thinner, and eventually we can have a direct perception with our mental consciousness, not with a sense consciousness. We realize emptiness or these hidden phenomena with a mental consciousness. So that's the potential, that's the power of our mental consciousness. Right now we use our mental consciousness usually most often in a very coarse way, a very gross way, in the way we talk about concepts and ideas and those sorts of things.
What I find confusing in this, okay, I was reading in the Satantrika Following Reasoning view, and I think they carry this over to Madhyamaka. They say that with our visual consciousness, we see, it appears, but we don't ascertain all these characteristics like subtle impermanence and all that. Mm-hmm. Is that carried over to Madhyamaka? Do you know? What's funny to me about that is, I guess I can kind of get it, like, okay, it's appearing, but we're not ascertaining it. And when we finally realize that all this is going to be with our mental consciousness, because Venerable said that very clearly. She said, you realize subtle impermanence with your mental consciousness. But what the Satantrika Following Reasoning are saying is you actually are, it's appearing to you, but you're not ascertaining it with your visual consciousness. And that just kind of, it seems kind of funny to me. Is that,
I think it goes through all the way to middle way consequence. And my understanding of that is that because subtle impermanence is a characteristic of this conventional phenomena, then because it's with, you can't separate it from.
So it's appearing even to your visual consciousness. Why doesn't it appear to your smell? You know what I mean? Like, why do they pick on the visual? Why are you hearing it?
Well, changing moment to moment. It's changing moment to moment. What is changing moment to moment? Not the I guess the smell.
Yes. Whatever it is.
Well, I think it depends on the object. You know how each object, what would be this? No.
Is it kind of like the main...
I was thinking in that direction, but if we think of an object that is clearly known, like bread. Bread is a taste object, but it's not the subtle impermanence of the taste of the bread. You'd still say it's the bread that's changing moment to moment.
It changes moment to moment.
Well, it does. You're right.
I think it's the way they make their definitions when they choose the one that's
dominant.
And Jeffrey's kind of torn that apart.
Okay.
That's
a good question.
It's all conventional, let's put it that way.
Yes. So, for instance, the emptiness of the cup is, we wouldn't say that the emptiness of the cup is appearing to our sense consciousness. That's something that's only known by a rational analysis, right? Or an ultimate analysis. That's not known by...
I thought soil impermanence was also not manifest, just like emptiness.
But there are different types of minds that know those. Like an ordinary mind can understand subtle impermanence, at least from the consequence point of view, whereas that's not true of the emptiness of the cup.
Okay, so where I get mixed up then is in Satantrika, they call a yogic perception.
Direct perception, yeah.
Of subtle impermanence, but...
Right, that's one
that
of the things that changes.
On.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not for middle-way consequence, no.
Yeah, so this is where I think it gets kind of confusing, because we're hearing things from different points of view, but they're not always categorized, and then it just is like a big mishmash, and you can't separate them out.
This is the value of taking one subject and studying it really thoroughly, and then moving on to the next one. And even doing that, it's going to be confusing. Yeah, okay. All right.
Thank you for taking my
question. Okay. Are you still bright, or are you starting to fade?
Fading.
Okay. So how about this? How about if for the next week, read through these different synonyms. Maybe how long is chapter? Read up to 153. Read up to permanent phenomena. And so we'll go through the synonyms for existent and maybe come up with, say, two syllogisms using some of these terms. So you can use selfless, existent, non-existent, and these different synonyms for existent, and try to include your own experience, okay? All right, and if you can begin memorizing the definitions, I have to confess, I've never really thoroughly memorized all eight of these. They all kind of sound similar, and I've left them that way, and that's not good. So I encourage you, start really cleanly from the very beginning, and let's memorize these, and perhaps we can do some debating next week. Okay? We can introduce some very simple debates that Venerable Chinny brought back a very nice booklet on introduction to debate or something like that, and we can begin using some of those.
Venerable, could you go over the homework?
Okay. So, read the definition of, so starting with existent and going through those synonyms, and we'll read through impermanent phenomena, the definition of impermanent phenomena, and examples of impermanent phenomena, and then stop with permanent phenomena. So that's what we'll cover next week. Using any of those concepts and things that you know in your life, two syllogisms each, and then just begin memorizing those definitions would be really helpful. And I really encourage you to find a study buddy and just go back and forth. How this works is if you just say, if I said, Venerable Yeshe, it's not possible to posit the definition of existent, what would you say? Is it possible to give a definition? No, please, you can do this. Is there a definition in this book of existent? There is. So you would say, why, Seppel? That's what you'd say. Why? Why are you saying that? Oh, so it is possible to posit that definition. Yes, you say. Well, posit that definition. And so then you just look in the book. You don't have to have it memorized at the beginning. You just look in the book and you say, an existent, that which is observed by reliable cognizer. Oh, so the definition of existence is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. Yes. Okay, and then you would say the exact same thing to me. And by doing this, we're repeating it at least four times, right? So by the end of that, it starts sticking in your mind. Now, what I found over the years is that, especially when you're memorizing a lot of things, it'll stick when you're doing it the first day, and then the next day you think, oh, it's not there. But if you do it again, it sticks more, and then by the third day, the third repetition, you've got it. This is how memorization works. It works for everyone this way. There's no exception. So I encourage you to find someone you feel safe working with and just start and do what you can. You know, at least memorize the definition of existent. What is it?
Which is observed by a reliable cognizer.
Excellent. That which is observed by a reliable cognizer. Okay. Yes.
I wanted to read something from the Fat Debate book because about the importance of the pillar and the pod.
Okay.
Right, because he was saying, so why do they spend time positing such subjects? And then Purdue pointed out, this type of reasoning suggests and leads one into the middle way school reasoning on emptiness. Because in the middle way school, phenomena exist, are objects of use, and are able to perform functions, but they exist merely conventionally and are not findable among their bases of designation. So here it is being shown that although John and Mary, or one's two hands exist, are objects of use and can perform functions, there is no one thing or combination of things which is John and Mary, or one's two hands. So it's just sharpening the mind for that. So I thought it was important to point out they're not like positing for the heck of it to waste time.
Good, thank you. And it's wonderful that you're reading through Debate, and so any of those things that you want to bring up in the next few weeks, please do, that are helpful.